Welcome to the Progress Your Health podcast with your hosts, Dr. Robert Mackey and Dr. Valerie Davidson, a husband and wife team who specialize in bioidentical hormone replacement therapy and functional medicine. They're here to help you lose weight, balance hormones, and age gracefully. It's their mission to motivate, educate, and empower you to take your health to the next level. And now your hosts, hormone experts, Dr. Mackey and Dr. Davidson.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Progress Your Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
So as usual, we have another question. This one today is from Tracy. For those of you that are new to the podcast, we're getting lots of new listeners as of late. We really appreciate that. You can visit our website, progressyourhealth.com. There's a tab up at the top in the navigation bar. It says, Ask the Doctor. Put in your name and email, ask your question. It gives us something very specific to talk about on the podcast. We really do appreciate we're getting a little bit of backlog, but that means we have unlimited episodes that we can do, and hopefully it provides everyone some value. Dr. Davidson, why don't you go ahead and read the question from Tracy?
Absolutely. Let's dive in here. So, hi, you've discussed in past podcasts that you shouldn't supplement with estrogen hormone replacement therapy if you are still cycling. I will be 50 in a few months and still cycling, albeit irregularly. My cycles will be 10 days long, 33 days long, 15 days long, etc. I'm taking bioidentical testosterone and progesterone. I am suffering from dry, creepy skin, brittle hair, achy joints, really intense brain fog, so much so that I might forget to attend an appointment or random names while in a conversation. I'm also struggling with some insomnia, waking at 4 a.m., and restless sleep, even though I am taking progesterone up to 200 milligrams per day, depending on where I am in my cycle. I am concerned that my brain is not getting enough estrogen, What is your solution if you aren't supplementing with estrogen, even though it might be fairly low in lab values, or at least the symptoms seem to show that? How do you help your patients find relief in the interim? Thank you.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there. To be honest, you know, she's 50 years old. Her cycle is sort of all over the place. So she's sort of in the throes, because she's still having a cycle, she's sort of in the throes of perimenopause. This is actually like one of those really bad spots for a woman to be in. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah. Because she's still cycling makes it more challenging. And you know what her question is, she needs estrogen, her estrogen's changing, but she's still cycling. So it makes her sort of, at least on the surface, it makes her, which is probably why she's not on it yet. You know, kudos to her doctor, that she's technically not a candidate for estrogen at this point.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm glad that she's getting lab values. Now, when you are cycling, every single day is a little different than the day before it or the day after, because your estrogen is changing, your progesterone is changing, and then you have a period. But what I'm seeing here with Tracy is, she says she's taking the progesterone. So I have a couple of ideas here. She's taking the progesterone. She says she changes it to pay, you know, based on her cycle, but now she doesn't really have a regular cycle. Her cycle might be 10 days, 33 days, 15 days. So you really can't change your progesterone too much if you're not really having a regular cycle. So if someone's having a regular 25, 28 day cycle, sure, you might cycle the progesterone and have them do it from day 14 till their next period. Or in a lot of times, even in someone that's cycling, I would do the progesterone all month long unless they're on a period. Then they stop it while they're on their period. So there's something to be said here with that progesterone, because somebody that does have active working ovaries, you can do what's called a progesterone challenge test if they haven't had a period in a while, is you actually give them progesterone for up to 7 days and then stop. And they should either start bleeding if their ovaries are active and so, you know, secreting estrogen, they will either start bleeding before that 7 days is up or shortly thereafter. So I'm wondering if she's taking that progesterone throughout the month, starting and stopping it, that might be causing a bleed.
Yeah, right. So almost like a withdrawal bleed. If she's reducing the dose at some point, that it might cause her to actually have a period. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Like you can see that in, you know, in cycling women. Now in women that are not cycling, like they're just going into menopause, like myself, is I can take progesterone all month long and not get a period. That's because the ovaries have stopped cycling. Now in Tracy's case, that could be the issue. So, you know, just the stop and starts of the progesterone, that could be the issue. I'm also thinking, and tell me what you think about this, is some people are really, their estrogen lining is so sensitive to hormones. I mean, you give them a little bit of estrogen and they will start bleeding, even though the value is still so low. So in Tracy's case, she might have very low levels of estrogen, but it's still stimulating her uterine lining.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's why this is such a challenging situation for not only for Tracy, but also for the practitioner, right? Because, you know, because she's still bleeding, you know, she's in some ways, this is where, and I know you and I've had situations like this over the years where actually giving her a little bit of estriol, a little bit of biased or just straight estriol could actually create some regularity to her cycle. Right.
Could exactly. I think we should go into that. Yeah. Yes.
So she's having all the physical symptoms of having low estrogen. Her brain's not working properly. She's got all the other classic signs. Lab values say that it's low, but her cycle's all over the place. So the bleeding says she's not a candidate for it, but her symptoms say otherwise, that she is a candidate for it. So by giving her some estrogen, there's a few ways you could do that. It actually could create some regularity in the short term and give her the relief that she's looking for. So now, you know, maybe her period might just stop completely by giving her a little bit. What are your thoughts about that?
Exactly. I think, and more than likely, I don't think her endometrial lining is super sensitive to the estrogen that she's making. I've seen that in cases where I do hormone replacement with women that are postmenopausal, you give them a little estrogen, they start bleeding. So I don't really think that is the case here. I think exactly what you're saying is kind of the stops and starts of the progesterone might be causing that lining to want to have a withdrawal bleed. And her body probably is lacking the estrogen, that doing a little bit of estrogen therapy, which we'll get into because there's so many different ways you can do that, could actually regulate out to those periods or make them stop completely. Now, let me back up a little bit. So Tracy says her lab values are showing that she has low estrogen. Now, like I was saying, every day is different when you're cycling. So, you know, one day might show low, like when you're on your period, your estradiol levels are low because the lining is sloughing. When you're on day 12, the estradiol level is pretty high. When you're on day 21, it starts to lower. So what might be a good thing to do with Tracy is actually to take a bigger, broader view and test her follicle stimulating hormone, that FSH, and her luteinizing hormone, the LH. So the FSH and the LH, those are, we used to call them releasing factors back in the 90s, and then they changed it to stimulating hormones. So they're not really hormones. They're supposed to stimulate the actual endocrine gland to produce hormones. They come from the brain, and it works in a negative feedback loop. So if Tracy's estradiol levels are truly low, you'll start to see that FSH in particular, the LH as well, which that's a whole nother talk about, but really the follicle stimulating hormone, that FSH, you'll start to see it rise because the brain is yelling at the ovaries, hey, you're not making enough estradiol, could you please make some more? So if her FSH is under 10, say it's like 6, she is not a candidate for estradiol. That right. means that her ovarian function is pretty good, you know, pushing out that estradiol. Now, if her FSH is closer to like 40, you know, then you're saying, okay, her ovaries aren't making that much estrogen. Even if her FSH is even closer to like 25 or 30, we know that there is a decline in the estrogen production from those ovaries. So in that case, that might be a good way or a good time to supplement, you know, Tracy with some kind of estrogen therapy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I would, looking at the estrogen in this situation, for one, she's 50, right? So we can assume that, now granted, that's not for every woman because we've had quite a few women into their 50s that are still cycling on their own with no estrogen whatsoever. So, but their numbers are going to look quite a bit different. On day 12, their estrogen is still going to be at a certain level, usually over 100, right? In this case, I guarantee you that Tracy's day 12, if we did it on day 12, if you could figure out where that was, or if you just did it randomly anytime.
I don't think you could figure out where her day 12
probably
is because her cycle is 10, 33 days long, 15 days
right.
long.
So if you just did it randomly, just a random estradiol on her, it's going to be probably less than 30 on all of them. At least less than 50. I mean, you know, I wouldn't expect it to be much more than that. But she's bleeding a lot, so I can see why she's not on any estrogen yet. But her symptoms, the one she's minus the bleeding, the one she's complaining about, those are all kind of classic signs of not having enough estrogen. So, you know, definitely this is the toughest spot, I think, as, you know, granted, I'm just a man, so I don't know much. But over the years, dealing with enough patients, I think this is the most challenging, as I said a minute ago, this is the most challenging situation right at the end of, you know, technically perimenopause. She's 50, so, and her symptoms sort of dictate or indicate that she's very close to being at the end of her menstrual history. This is a really tough spot to be.
Yeah, so like I said, in somebody that might have a higher level of that FSH and that estradiol level might be lower, I would say, you know, doing a low dose Biest. So Biest is a combination of estriol E3 and estradiol E2. Now, estradiol is the strongest form of estrogen, so we may want to do a really low to maybe no dose of estradiol in that Biest, maybe, you know, or and just do an estriol only. I've seen some really good results with doing an estriol only, doing that topically as a cream. For women that are just going right into that menopause, you know, because it is a phase, you know, perimenopause transitions into menopause. It's a phase like puberty. So I would say probably doing maybe starting off with some estriol or maybe even, like I was saying, a really low dose Biest. So maybe, 10% estradiol and 90% estriol.
Yeah.
But so at the same time, sorry to interrupt you, but at the same time to... This is the part you can't let Tracy go off on her way. Here, take this Biest and, you know, see a gal. It's okay. Let's do your levels in, you know, 60 days, in 30 days. What are your symptoms in the next 2 months? Do you get a period? Does it regulate out? You know, that's where, and somebody in this case, it's not like you can give them some hormones and I'll see you in a year or 6 months. I've got to see you sooner so we can test what your body wants to do. Cause I have seen in women in this situation, or even right when they start to, hey, I haven't had a period in 6 months, I'm having menopausal symptoms, I give them some hormone therapy that consists of Biest, the estriol and the estradiol, and all of a sudden their ovaries are like, I'm back in business, you know, I'm doing this again, and then you have to remove it. So sometimes you can use that Biest kind of like training wheels for the ovaries.
Right. Yeah, I've had situations like this before too, where there are, you know, just, you know, that irregularity is just sort of dominating everything. And I, you know, not that we use it all the time, but I've also used rhythmic dosing in these situations. And so that way you can create more, you know, regularity. They're still going to be bleeding, but now you can schedule the bleeding so it's not all over the place. And their physical symptoms, the ones that they're complaining about, actually tend to resolve. Okay, so it is on the surface, like I said, it's very contradictory because usually bleeding indicates no estrogen. But like you said,
bleeding indicates what?
No estrogen.
Having a bleed.
What I meant was if they're bleeding, if they're having a period,
yes,
then they're not a candidate for estrogen therapy yet.
Gotcha.
But that's sort of, you know, sort of a fine line between yes and no. Right now I'd say, based, and like you said, the FSH is a really good point, that maybe she actually is. Maybe she's more of a, even though she's bleeding, maybe she's more of a candidate based on some of those other parameters.
And just to, you know, what we're trying to do with somebody that's cycling, and the reason we're not giving them that estrogen is, one, it could make them feel really crummy and PMS-y all the time because you're putting estrogen on top of estrogen. But two is you're trying to protect that endometrial lining. You don't want to get, you know, have that endometrial lining, the inside of the uterus, get too thick. That can be a risk factor for uterine cancer. So what I would say with, you know, with Tracy, and she didn't say here, you know, I would love, I mean, please, when you write us some, you know, write us your questions, write as long as you want, write a book if you want to, because all the detail makes, you know, really puts together the case. But doing a transvaginal ultrasound, Tracy could have some fibroids that are getting irritated by the little bit of estrogen she's making. She could have some polyps. Polyps are actually very common. They're completely benign. They're not precancerous. They're uterine polyps. It's just some of the uterine lining has lifted up and it looks like a little polyp, you know, and it has a consistency of jello and they move around a little bit and it irritates the blood vessels at the base of that, you know, where the polyp's coming from, and it causes bleeding. You can get bleeding. Somebody with polyps can have bleeding with a bowel movement. I mean, I've had polyps before and had to have them removed in my 30s. Is, you know, they run in families. You can have a little bit of bleeding if you have polyps after intercourse, after going for a jog. So it could be that Tracy might have some polyps or fibroid in there that it's really not that she's not a candidate for estrogen. It's just, we need to look at the inside of her uterus.
I would imagine that she didn't mention that, any of that, but I would imagine that her practitioner's probably done a transvaginal ultrasound at this point.
Not exactly. Not all practitioners order
I would bet that she probably.
Yeah, so happened. I would say doing that. So if the uterus looks clear, you know, but, or maybe there is a thickened lining. So let's say you do a transvaginal ultrasound and the lining's at 8, then you know that.
So, back up there a second. So what does that mean?
So that means that you can measure the thickness of what the uterine lining is inside the uterus. So in a cycling woman, when they have their period, that entire uterine lining gets sloughed off. It's clean again. You start back at, you know, which is basically day one. You start off, you know, you start back at a clean uterine lining. And then as that estrogen starts to build through that 28-day cycle, the estrogen is causing that lining of the uterus to thicken up. It hits day 12. That's when it's really going to surge a bunch of estrogen. Then when you have ovulation, progesterone kind of comes in with that uterine lining and kind of restructures the architecture of that lining to make it nice and solid. So if there is fertilization, that fertilized egg has a really nice comfy place that it can, you know, nestle in there and stay fixed to for pregnancy. Now, sometimes some people, when they do have in perimenopause, they have low progesterone. Classic perimenopause progesterone is having low progesterone is it can make the uterine lining sloppy. So they'll get sort of a lot of like bleeds throughout the month. You know, just a spotting after their period, spotting before their period. So that can happen. So I can see, you know, Tracy's on her progesterone to correct for that. So you can correct for irregular bleeding and perimenopause from that lack of progesterone by providing that progesterone. So I'm thinking with Tracy, if she did do a transvaginal ultrasound, and you're right, most doctors are, you know, it's pretty easy. Just
well, the bleeding makes everybody nervous.
Yeah.
The frequent bleeding makes everybody nervous.
So they'll do that ultrasound, of course, depending on where you are in your cycle, they'll check that lining and you can measure the lining. You can measure, you know, how thick it is. And
so you mentioned 8 millimeters, whatever. So what's normal and what's not normal?
So in a postmenopausal female, you really want it to be closer to 2. They say normal is under 5, but really you want that lining to be a 2. But there was one time I did a transvaginal ultrasound in my 30s. I was right after, I think I was on day 24 or 22. My uterine lining was really thick. It was at 16.
Because you're getting ready for your period.
Yeah, I was getting ready to, you know, but if I had done that transvaginal ultrasound when I've done one, you know, on day 4 or day, you know, 5, it's pretty thin because I just had the period and then it's got thinner. So I would say for Tracy, maybe, you know, doing a transvaginal ultrasound, like you said, she would have said if she had polyps or fibroids. But now, just because Tracy's question does kind of reflect a whole bunch of other people out there. You know, a lot of other women are probably experiencing this. So if you are having irregular bleeding, transvaginal ultrasound would give us a lot of insight into that.
Yeah. But it is, like you mentioned, though, it is a little bit of a mixed bag, depending on when in your cycle you're going to get that ultrasound. Because, you know, it's going to change, right? You know, now in a menopausal woman, a woman that hasn't had a period in a while, that is where it's totally different. You want that to be less than 6 millimeters. Like you said, that's where you want to be closer to 2 millimeters. But if the lining is over 6, that's where the increased risk of endometrial cancer, that's what we're trying to prevent in hormone replacement therapy. That's why you take your estrogen, but you have to take the progesterone at the same time because it prevents that lining growth.
Now, like you have always said, and I believe this too, hormones can't cause cancer. You know, I still feel like, you know, the insulin, we've always talked about the insulin issue with being elevated, that, you know, you combine high levels of insulin and then you have this and you're not protecting the uterus, then that could be a little breeding ground.
Well, cancer itself, that there's this idea, and we are not going to talk about this too much right now, but there's this idea that cancer is a genetic problem. And there's some new thinking around that cancer is more of a metabolic disease as opposed to it being solely a genetic issue. Like, you don't have any control over a genetic problem. You're just sort of at the whim that, you know, if your DNA is mutated or not, you develop with a cancer. If it's a metabolic disease, that means that it's a lifestyle problem. You know, cancer is something that we, you know, not that we put it on upon ourselves, but, you know, let's be honest, the standard American diet, refined carbohydrates, trans fats, all these things kind of push us towards metabolic dysfunction. That's where the insulin part comes into play. And that's a kind of a cancer breeding ground. In this particular instance, though, if we're looking at, you know, if you, you know, like, for example, the number one rule of hormone replacement is you never give a woman with a uterus, you never give her unopposed estrogen. Like Tracy, not that you would, but let's just say hypothetically, she's on a bunch of estrogen and no progesterone. That wouldn't be good for Tracy. Now, honestly, she probably just have lots of bleeding, right? Eventually she's going to stop that, or whoever doctor gave her that, you know, that idea is going to change it at some point. You can give a woman progesterone all day long, no problem. That doesn't affect anything. There's no risk to that. But it is specifically for a woman with a uterus with static dosing. That's what we're talking about. Same dose every day. The goal there is to help their symptoms, but also protect the uterus at the same time.
Absolutely. So I would say, you know, Tracy is kind of going along the same lines as, I mean, my gosh, a lot of women listening that I would, you know, I would consider, as long as we had a good relationship and she's going to follow up and do the blood work when I want her to, is, you know, I would say probably she would be a candidate for a real low dose biased.
Yeah.
And she'd probably feel really good.
So just a ballpark, like when you say low dose, I think our low dose converses to other practitioners' low dose. What would you say?
What would you say?
In a situation like this, because of the frequency, I'd say somewhere between 1 to 3 milligrams.
Of a, what kind of ratio?
I mean, you could do an easily an 80-20, like you said, a 90-10. Mm-hmm. You could just do straight estriol too.
Yeah, I would probably do a 90-10 biased, mm-hmm. probably at closer to like 2 milligrams, 90-10, and then they do a half, she would do a half a milligram twice a day, or a woman in this
situation. So let's explain that, how we would do that. So when we write a prescription for someone, we are doing, we like to do it as our default. When a woman is starting, she's doing let's say using a TopiClick, that's a pretty common device. Women that have used hormone replacement know what a TopiClick is. So 2 clicks twice a day. So 2 clicks is equal to a half a gram of hormone, right? So whatever we want them to have for the total day, that's what the prescription's written for. And they're doing half of that dose in the morning. Let's say it's 2 milligrams, or they're doing 1 milligram in the morning, 2 clicks, and then 1 milligram in the evening, which is also 2 clicks, right?
And just to break that up, if you did that 90-10, that would be, you know, 0.9 estriol, 0.1 estradiol. If you were going to, you know, that would be that's equal to 1 milligram of biased 90-10. Now, 1 milligram of biased 80-20 would be 0.8 estriol and 0.2 estradiol.
Yeah.
So it's a little more estradiol when you're doing the 80-20 ratio versus the 90-10. But honestly, with compounding pharmacies, you can do any, you know, milligram, microgram, anything you wanted, they can make. Now, Tracy may be going through a big box pharmacy and taking Prometrium, it says right here, taking progesterone 200 milligrams per day. She might be taking Prometrium, which is a big box, big pharma type of medication, which only comes in 100 milligrams and 200 milligrams. Because with a compounding pharmacy, I could easily change her progesterone, you know, to 125, to 150, 175, 100. There's so many different things you can do with a compounding pharmacy. So I would say coming up with really more of an individualized recipe for Tracy or any female going through the situation would probably be ideal, because just doing the, you know, those basic big pharma cookie cutter doses, you're probably going to run into problems. Like big pharma, at least here in the United States, you can't necessarily get an estriol. We get them from compounding pharmacies. So Tracy wouldn't be able to get that if she was just going through like CVS or Walgreens.
Yeah, right. There's no estriol commercially available, meaning big box pharmacy version of estriol.
Now there is estradiol, but I would never recommend Tracy at her age, what she's doing and showing that she's still cycling. I would never just put her on like an estradiol tab. I don't like estradiol orally anyway, or estradiol gel or anything.
Or a patch.
Oh gosh, no. It would be really more maybe an estriol with a tiny bit of estradiol in it. So she'd have to go through a compounding pharmacy.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to be, well, she's already using bioidentical hormones. So obviously
how do you know she's using? Oh, I guess she says
bioidentical testosterone.
She's already familiar with it. You're right. I read that, didn't I?
Yeah.
Oh, there goes my brain fog.
Yeah.
I better wrap up my estrogen.
Yeah. I think you need some more.
Yeah, do I?
I was going to mention that to you.
Oh, but sure.
Just as we're talking about it, I was going to mention that a little bit. I'm just teasing. I mentioned the other day, you and I were, you and I are arguing about something, and I said, is this menopause? And you got mad at me because I threw the menopause card at you.
You deal with menopause and menopausal women and hormone replacement all the time. You can't just shout that out.
Well, you were acting a little hysterical.
Is that menopause?
I'm just teasing. I'm just teasing. You're right.
I know you started laughing when I said that.
Yeah. Well, you got mad.
I started laughing.
You got mad. You didn't laugh at the moment.
What are you doing?
You didn't laugh at the moment. You got really mad at me. I was like, whoa.
You know better than that.
Well, yeah, but it's sort of tongue in cheek. You know,
I know.
Even though I'm using it against you, it's still tongue in cheek. I know. I know I'm annoying. I know that all husbands are ridiculous. You know, all the things we do just drive the women crazy, right? I hear it all the time. You know, whatever the husband does, you know, just drives the women nuts. The way he breathes, the way he chews, he leaves his socks around, he does this, he does that, and they just want to strangle. 1 minute they love them, and the next minute they want to strangle them.
And you were not saying that in reference to me. These are other women patients you've talked to.
I'm just
putting that out there.
No. I'm just saying it in generalized terms. This is the feedback that I get. And they don't, you know, they don't like it that way. They never used to feel that way, right? They never used to feel that way. They've always been a certain level of demeanor. And all of a sudden, like a flip of a light switch, everything changes. And they don't understand why.
You know, with the perimenopause, that's where that starts.
Well, that's where it starts. Yeah. It continues well into menopause, but now they might have 5 years under their belt dealing with those kind of emotional swings. You know, the pendulum goes from, you know, rage to crying and everything in between, and they don't understand. But by the time they're in menopause, they've already been dealing with it for a while, and they have the husband trained, so he's like walking on eggshells every time something goes wrong. But
those poor husbands.
Oh no, they're fine. They're fine. I'm fine. I'm just teasing, for sure. Because this is where it gets complicated. Our hormones are changing, both males and females, whether we want them to or not. Environmental factors, stress, sleep, you know, all these things are dictating our hormonal response, our hormonal landscape on a daily basis. And the 21st century, with all the conveniences that we have, the toxin load, which we don't even really talk about that much, but the toxin load is crazy. All the microplastics everyone's talking about, the phthalates and all these different chemicals that you and I probably need to get into a little bit more. We don't really spend too much time on those things. But at the same time, it's like, you know, how do you, now granted, there's some obvious things you can do in your own environment, just to minimize as much of those chemicals as possible. But we live in a polluted world, like literally the air, the water, the soil, everything is polluted in one way or another. We just have to sort of pick our battles and figure out what's the best way to approach those things. So we'll talk more about, you know, I have some ideas about that, but we're getting off on a tangent, so we'll talk more about that later. But so Tracy, I think she's definitely a candidate potentially. This is where you can't really predict on how she's going to respond. We're saying that maybe a little estrogen wouldn't be a bad idea, but it could go horribly wrong and she starts bleeding a lot, or it could go really well.
That's why you stay in communication, right? You know, I want to know if you're going to be, you know, do your periods regulate out? Do you never have a period? Like, what? That's why that, you know, having that follow-up.
Well, to be honest now, if her bleeding got better, you wouldn't hear from her, right? At least not for a while anyways. But if it got sure. even worse than it already is, then you'd hear from her right away. But that's the thing. The practitioner, lab values, all the lab testing in the world will not predict whether she can handle the estrogen or not. So it's just a little bit of a... You know, we used to live in Las Vegas where I was a little bit of a roll of the dice a little bit of a crapshoot to see if she's going to be able to, if it's going to do well for her, or if she's still a little too early and she could be a candidate. It sounds like she is, but she might not be a candidate.
That's what we were saying, you know, start with a low dose. If you did estriol, she more than likely wouldn't have a negative reaction, you know. That's about as low as you can go, and then you can work your way up. It's better to start low and then work your way up than doing overkill and having to back your way out of that.
So another way you could do that too, like I was just thinking, you know, it's like, let's say you did a prescription for like 4 milligrams per gram of an estriol. One click would be 1 milligram, right? That way it would give a little flexibility that she could kind of gradually.
I see where you're going, but I don't, but you can't, that's why I would do more like 2 milligrams, because I would rather her do a little bit less. So if we needed to increase it, we could. When they're doing that one click of that one milligram, you cannot reduce that.
Yeah, but would you really need to go less than one milligram?
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody's different. Some people are more sensitive than others.
I disagree.
And I usually don't like it when they try to change their doses by themselves. And I get it. guys are adults. You're smart. You know what you're doing. But there is still, if I don't know what you're doing, if I think you're doing,
well,
one
I don't
thing,
mean them going rogue. I mean, it's with a little bit of supervision. It's not about going rogue.
Oh yeah, no, that's
experimentation with hormones is not a good idea.
No, not a good idea. You know, we want to know what you're doing.
You got to have a little bit of understanding of what you're doing and why you're doing it. You know, absolutely. I'm just saying that if you are starting at a certain point, okay, fine. You do 2 milligrams, so that way one click would be a half a milligram, right?
No,
2 milligrams. If you did it for 2, which you said, now we're getting into the weeds here.
I love the math.
Yeah, this is a doctor conversation about people listening. Like, what are they talking about?
What is this math stuff?
Yeah. Two milligrams would be a half a milligram per click. 2 milligrams would be a half a milligram per click. So that way, you know, one click,
yes,
2 clicks would be 1 milligram, 3 clicks would be 1.5 milligrams, and then 4 clicks would be the 2 milligrams. That would be flexible.
Yeah, that's what I would say. You could kind of move it around a little bit. That's usually what I do. That way we have a
little
flexibility.
My favorite number is 4. That's why I like the number 4.
Oh, really? Okay.
That's my favorite number.
All right, let's bet on 4. Yeah, well, horse number 4.
Well, your favorite number is 3.
Is it?
Yeah.
No, I like 15. I like 5s. I guess I do. Yeah. I like 3s.
Well, you said your favorite number is 33. My favorite number is 44.
That's just something that, I don't want to give away my passwords. Okay. Something easy to remember.
You don't have that on any of your passwords. Do you?
Yeah, I do.
Do you really? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Something. I thought I knew all your passwords. You have one particular couple that you like, but it wasn't that.
I have. Change them around because I got to update your password.
Yeah. Tracy did write in 2 questions back to back. So we have another question from Tracy we're going to do on the next one. It's about thyroid. Just a little bit of a hint. She doesn't have a thyroid.
Which we'll get into because
I find to be a little fascinating, because people that don't have a thyroid gland fall into a completely different category than everyone else that has Hashimoto's, and she is taking compounded thyroid. So, we'll talk about that on the next episode. I think that is, a very unique and kind of an interesting situation. We prescribe, compounded thyroid for thyroidectomy patients all the time. What is your guess? I don't know if she even says in there. I haven't read the question. Reese, I just read the first sentence of it. Do you think she's had cancer or what? Or is it just hyperthyroid?
Oh no, probably had thyroid cancer. I mean, we'll talk about that in the next one. Like you said, that totally changes Tracy's whole aspect here. But you know, with every female that's, you know, in 50 going from perimenopause to menopause, they're going to experience a lot of the same things that Tracy's having here with they're almost like a candidate for the menopausal, you know, the estrogen, but at the same time, they're not. They're in that limbo land between perimenopause and menopause. Every single woman's going to go through that, you know, and some are going to have more intense symptoms and some are going to have, you know, very little symptoms. So it depends on the person. So the thyroid thing does kind of change up the situation, which we'll go into in the next podcast.
Yeah. And the fact that she doesn't have a gland, I think, is fairly unique and sort of interesting. So I think we satisfied Tracy's question, at least for what we feel is sufficient for now. Do you have anything else to add? Any closing comments?
No, anybody has any questions about this? If you're in the same boat, you know, reach out and send us a message.
Yeah, progresshealth.com. Go to click on the Ask a Doctor tab, ask your question. Until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Progress Your Health podcast. If you like what you've heard on this podcast, please give us a positive review on iTunes. This allows us to spread our message, grow our audience, and help more people around the world. For more information, visit our website at progressyourhealth.com.